Okay, so we're back in 1 Corinthians. We're in the 7th chapter. We covered part of this chapter last time. This chapter is the longest discourse in the New Testament on the matter of marriage and divorce, so it's important for us. And as I suggested last time, kind of in part one to this chapter, there are really four passages that one has to look at to talk about marriage and divorce in the New Testament. One is from Matthew 5. It's just a couple of verses in the Sermon on the Mount. And then Matthew 19 and then Romans 7, verses 1 to 4, briefly mentions it. All three of those talk about marriage and whether you can get a divorce under the law. It's Matthew 5, verses 31 to 32, Matthew 19, 3 to 12, and then Romans 7, 1 to 4. And the Romans 7 passage just uses 7, 1 to 4. It just uses the law to illustrate something. It's really talking about soteriology and how we get saved and such. But it uses an illustration, and it says if the husband dies under the law, the wife could remarry. So there's nothing really surprising there. But the Matthew 19 passage has been the subject of a lot of debate. And what I was suggesting earlier, kind of talking before we got started, is that Jesus is answering the question, can I get a divorce for any reason? Because that's what the Jewish men wanted to do. And he's answering it under the law. And he says, no, you can't. Why? Because God's design intent for marriage back in Genesis is that it is permanent. Now, if you look in Genesis for that part where God says it's permanent except when she, you know, doesn't cook well or wants the mother-in-law to move in, it's not there. There's just marriage is permanent, that's it. It doesn't have any exception. And so when Jesus says that, you go back and read Genesis, there's no exception. They say, well, then why under the law did Moses say you could get a certificate of divorce? Okay, that's a passage in Deuteronomy. And the issue seems to be that because he says it, because of the hardness of your hearts. In other words, God told you men to keep your wives, but you're bad guys, you're sinners, and so you're divorcing them for whatever reason. And so Moses is regulating that, not approving it, but regulating it. You have to give her a certificate of divorce. That way she won't be destitute and she could possibly remarry. And he says, but that was never God's plan. So that's kind of what he says in Matthew 19. Where a lot of the debate comes in is he makes one exception. He says you can divorce for no reason except porneia. There's a different word for adultery. And usually when I hear this taught, people will just routinely say, yeah, you can only get a divorce for adultery. The text doesn't say that. And it's caused a lot of debate. Well, because porneia is a much broader term. That could be any kind of sexual sin. That could be you reading one of those big pictures, right? You're really reading the interviews, right? But it's like a pin-up or whatever. That would be porneia. Modern days, people don't need magazines anymore like they did in the old days. They have internet. You can just search anything, and all kinds of free pictures will come up. That's porneia. Sex with someone while you're not married, that's porneia. So it's just it's a broad term, and it's led to a lot of debate. However that comes out, Jesus was interpreting the law, and he says, except for that narrow circumstance, you can't get a divorce. And it surprises his disciples who say, no, maybe nobody should get married, is their response. God expects marriage to be permanent. Paul, in this chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians, is addressing, in the only place that really talks about it, that isn't in the context of the law of Moses. And so it's helpful for us. But he reiterates kind of what Jesus said, like God intended people would just stay married. So I think I covered through chapter 7, verse 16 last time, but just a big picture of review. Remember, Paul got a letter, and they had questions. The Corinthians had questions like we do, and it had to be kind of neat in those days, because then you could just write the apostle a letter and say, listen, Paul, I need to know definitively these questions. And they did. And they asked about marriage, and they asked about when you get to chapter 8, they asked about, can you eat meat that was sacrificed to idols? And they had all these questions. So Paul starts in 7:1 in response to the matters you wrote. He says, I'm responding to your letter. And it seems that the problem that may have arisen in that church And I think it seems foreign to us because the idea of being a monk and choosing a life of poverty, which means a life of no working, and sort of living in a cave or something that looks like a dungeon and just doing chants and praying 24 hours a day and all that, I don't think any of us want to do that. But there was a big movement in the early parts of the church, and it lasted for centuries, and there are still people today that are called monks, different kinds of monks, Franciscans and Jesuits and different things, who had this ascetic lifestyle, and part of that was always celibacy. And the ones who were already married who decided to become monks would have a no-sex marriage, okay? It's not a surprise to me in this culture that would have arisen as a problem, because they associated sexual relationship with worship, because that was the temple. There was a temple in the background there on that mountain in Corinth. It had temple prostitutes, and so when they thought of worship, they thought of having sex. I mean, that was just it. Why would you worship by having sex? Because you worship fertility goddesses and gods, and if you can get them aroused, it will rain and your crops will grow. I mean, that is how they thought. And so now that they're a Christian, they've put all that aside. They're like, well, maybe we shouldn't have sexual relationship anymore. And so Paul starts off in kind of an unusual way, and I think he's quoting what they think, which he agrees with only in part. It's good for a man and not to have sexual relations with a woman. But then he goes on and explains people have different sex drives, and those who need to have sex should be married, and they have an outlet in which to have that need fulfilled. And so he'll say very clearly in these opening verses, don't withhold, you know, that is, the husband should not make a unilateral decision that their marriage is now going to be a celibate one. Nor the wife, neither one. And he says the only time you would withhold is because for a short period of time and by mutual agreement, because you're going to have a time of prayer, so it would be like maybe a time of fasting. You're going to fast for 3 days, and it'll be a 3 days of no sex because you're praying and fasting. And he says that's okay, then come back together. That's a nice way of saying have sex again. So he addresses that, but he has to address not just these people who decided to be celibate, but other questions like, should the married people divorce? Should the unmarried people get married? That's the kinds of questions. So he has this idea that, in general, stay in the place where you are. And it seems because he anticipates something bad's going to happen. He calls it the present distress. He just doesn't tell us what it is. Nobody knows. If there is a present distress, you can understand why that could be more difficult if you're married and more difficult if you have children. But Paul never prohibits the marriage. He just says that would be better. And he also has a concern that we get so wrapped up in sort of worldly things that we lose sight of the heavenly things. And even within a marriage, your whole life can then revolve around that, where God is sort of left out. And he's concerned about that too. So he speaks to, in verses 8 and 9, he speaks to the unmarried. Starting in verse 10, he speaks to the married. And he has to deal in verses 10 to 16 with a common problem, which is a man in Corinth becomes a Christian, but his wife is not. Should he divorce her or stay married? Or it could be just the opposite. Woman in Corinth becomes a Christian, wife is not. I'm sorry, husband is not Christian. Should they stay married? And I shared, you know, a week ago, like just as an illustration of someone I knew who, when he became a Christian from a Muslim family, his wife immediately left him. And as far as I'm aware, that never stopped. I mean, she left him and that was it. Because he converted. Like, it wasn't thinking about it. It was just, we're out of here. That's a culture where you don't do that. I've had testimonies I've heard of people who were Jewish and became a Christian in modern times, and their family disowns them. I mean, that just happens. And husbands or wives may leave. And what Paul says, if they're willing to stay with you now that you're a Christian, then stay married. Okay? You can stay married. There may have been a concern that if you were married to a non-Christian, that's kind of unclean, and not only that, or essentially unclean in a way that, like, God wouldn't approve of it. And Paul says in these verses 10 through 16, says, no, that's not the case. You can stay married. If they leave, that's a different thing. But if they'll stay with you, stay married. So can a Christian be married to a non-Christian? Paul says yes. Now, he will say later, If you're unmarried and you're a Christian, don't go marry a non-Christian. That's a different question. But the issue of if you're, you become a Christian and you're already married, you don't leave them because I became a Christian, now I've got to leave you. That's nonsense. So that makes sense? Is there a question about that part so far? We haven't got to the hard questions yet. But.
The thing about it is, these people have been judged with all these rules and regulations for a long time, and now all of a sudden you're changing. You're just not going to lose all the time that you have for all these rules.
Yeah, but and keep in mind, though, the ones...
It's common sense, kind of.
Yeah, but the ones in Corinth are primarily Gentile, right? So Paul's Jewish, obviously, and it's not to say there's no Jews in Corinth. It's a good sized city. It was a major city, for trade, but they're mostly Gentile. Whereas when you're reading the book of Romans, it's obvious there's but Rome was the big city. There were a lot of Jewish people in the Roman church. He's primarily speaking to people who are Gentiles. Who a few months ago, their worship was going up on the mountain to the prostitutes. I mean, that's who he's dealing with. And they've grown up, worship was making sacrifices to idols and all of that. So it's a weird thing, but it gives you the background for why they would think maybe if I become a Christian and he or she, the spouse, is not, maybe I've got to leave them, I think in our culture, we don't even think about it. But, I mean, maybe we would. They seem to. Well, he continues then where I don't think we got last time in verse 17, with what seems to be kind of his main point, which is in general, stay put, remain as you are, not as a command. He's just saying, we tend to lose sight sometimes that we're in a place where God has put us. He's used our decisions, good and bad, maybe to get us here. But it's in our nature to always sort of be on the move. Single person wants to be married. Married person wants to be single. Person at this job wants the job at the other place. Person who lives in Chapel Hill wants to live in Brenham. The person in Brenham wants to live in Chapel Hill. We're just like that. And Paul's like, God's placed you somewhere. Why don't you serve faithfully where you are? Not wrong if you decide you want to move to Brenham, but you don't need to seek it either. It's kind of, life will sort of unfold and God will lead you in this direction or that. But and the same thing applies to the marriage part. He kind of says, stay where you are. So look what he says. Let each one live his life in the situation the Lord assigned. See that there? You don't just happen to be here today. I mean, not saying God controls every event and takes your volition away, but God works things out in a way that gets us where we should be. Stay in the situation God assigned when God called him. This is what I command in all the churches. Was anybody already circumcised when he was called? Who would a circumcised person generally be? Yeah, Jewish person, right? Because when God pulled out Abraham and Abraham becomes the first Jewish man, he instigates this idea of being circumcised, and that later becomes part of the law. Young Jewish boys circumcised the eighth day. Paul will make reference to that in his own life. Jesus was circumcised. So he says, if you were circumcised, he should not undo his circumcision. Now, that may strike us as odd, but that has a historical basis. Or sometimes people who were circumcised would try to get some modest surgical procedure to hide it. I'm not making this stuff up. You can read books about it. There is at least one reference, and I'm forgetting where it's at now. It's maybe an Old Testament reference to them actually doing this. And all Paul's saying is, again, it's this general idea. Flourish where God assigned you. Doesn't mean that you should never change. It doesn't mean you'd never seek a promotion. Doesn't mean you'd never think about moving. But as soon as sort of your life gets revolved around the next move, you're always fighting to make the next move until you die, never having arrived where you wanted to arrive, right? When you could have served well where you started. So the circumcised person should not undo his circumcision. Was anyone called while uncircumcised? That would be Gentiles. He should not get circumcised. And it's interesting that that probably has more to do than it probably has more going on than just the physical of being circumcised. I've always wondered how in the old days you would get adults to line up for circumcision, but apparently it wasn't that hard. The book of Galatians, you go read that book. The whole background of that book is that when Paul left Some of those churches he planted in the area called Galatia. There were a number of churches, not just one. These folks came in who started saying, you know, you Gentiles, in order to really be Christians, kind of got to be Jewish. Step number one, men, line up. Let's, you know, snip, snip, and after you get better, we'll start teaching you, you know, how to keep the law. And Paul's very dogmatic that they don't need to. So that could be kind of in the background, but he's just saying you don't need to change. You were a Gentile when God called you, now serve as a Gentile. You were a Jewish guy when God called you, serve as a Jewish guy. Circumcision does not matter. Now, why wouldn't it matter? You know, if the law of Moses were still around, it'd matter a whole lot. But it doesn't matter because it's just an outward fleshly thing. He's not saying it's bad. He's not saying it's good. He's saying it had nothing. It's just not important.
It talks about it in one area where it says it's not circumcision of your privates, but circumcision of your heart.
Yeah, Romans 2. That the true circumcision is an internal thing. Keep in mind, you know, circumcision was to separate them from the surrounding peoples. And so the cutting away the flesh is like the removal of sin. It's just symbolic. And Paul says that's outward. It doesn't actually do anything. It's what's in the heart that matters. That's Romans 2. But here, it's kind of the same thing. Circumcision does not matter, and uncircumcision doesn't matter. It's a totally neutral thing. Sometimes, people have these questions. Well, should we get our baby son baptized? If you want to. It's not a biblical command one way or the other. Keeping God's commands is what matters. And he's just saying, you know, obedience to God is what matters. These outward things, they're not moral. They're not moral issues at all. Let each of you remain in the situation in which he was called. Now he's going to make it tougher, though. That sounds good so far, but listen to this. He's going to get real politically incorrect. Were you called while a slave? So called, by the way, that word called means invited, and so Paul will often use that. He's talking about the invitation through the gospel message to become a Christian. Were you called while you were a slave? When we use that word, I think for us it conjures up imagery of the slavery that proliferated in this country for a long time, that was an evil that the church largely did not stand against, only the Quakers did, but we should have stood against. It has nothing to do with the slavery in this time. Now, I'm not saying the slavery in this time that Paul writes is all good. But you need to understand that the estimates are, like in Rome, as many as half the people were slaves. I've mentioned before that Luke may well have been a slave. It was common for the slaves to be well-trained. It was not always the case. You certainly had slaves that worked out in the farmland picking crops. That was the worst you could have. You had a lot of rich folks that had household slaves, and they would be well-trained. It would be not uncommon for you to own a slave, have that slave educated, become an accountant, become an engineer, become a physician like Luke. And it was not even uncommon for Romans to adopt their slaves. The concept of adoption in our New Testament is not usually adopting little children. It's adopting an adult who will inherit everything you have. If you ever watch the movie Ben-Hur with Charlton Heston, right? Former president of NRA, Charlton Heston's character, Ben-Hur, is adopted by a Roman general as an adult. And that will make him a wealthy man because he will inherit all that general had. So, and what was he in the movie, though? He was a slave. All right. So I'm just saying it's different. And there was a concept we call manumission. Manumission is that slaves could buy their way out. Okay, Roman slaves generally were compensated, although not compensated a lot, but they were compensated. And what they would hope to do after a time is buy their freedom. It was not uncommon for one to sell oneself into slavery because you either couldn't take care of yourself or had some great debt.
How would they acquire a slave in those times?
Well, so several ways. One is you might sell yourself because you have a debt, like I said. And the other is you may, you know, if you owned a slave, you could sell them. And in fact, we'll have a verse here, either this chapter or the next, that will mention it. I mentioned on the first day of class, in the middle of Corinth, there's a market. The market's called the Agora. One of the things you could buy in the Agora, besides, you know, chicken and fish and all that, is people. You could buy people. And Paul will use that word in 1 Corinthians. He'll say, you were bought with a price. It's the word for buying people, and clearly that's the context. Jesus Christ bought us. What price did he pay? What price?
His life.
Yeah, his life, his blood, right? And but if he bought us, what does that imply? He owns us. If he owns us, who's in charge? See, you were purchased, he says, out of the marketplace of sin to become his slave to righteousness. The Apostle Paul will talk about that in Romans. He'll say, you know, you no longer need to yield dominion to sin, but you have become a slave of righteousness as you yield your members to Christ. So you have this idea, and I say that just because all of this stuff, you know, if we think of slavery in the sense of what, you know, continued here into the 1860s, and then we kept the South segregated for another century, you would think that a slave should always run away, maybe even kill their master to get away. And Paul will say the opposite in the Old Testament, in the New Testament, and you'll get some modern critics who, you know, they wax eloquent. Maybe they've got some diploma from an institution of higher learning that says they're smart. And slavery 2,000 years ago in a different empire is not the same as what happened in the United States. And I don't by that mean that it's all good. What I'm telling you is it's very different. So when we start reading slave, we need to understand what they're talking about. And someone might have been a slave because they volunteered for it. Someone else might not have. And there was a whole set of Roman laws around it. If you had children as a slave, then the owner would own the child. So there's all these laws. But they would seek to buy their way out. And that's why you see him say to the slave, were you called while a slave? Did you become a Christian? Were you evangelized while you're a slave? Don't let it concern you.
Were a lot of slaves conquered people, though? I think the Romans turned most of the countries where they conquered, they turned them into slaves.
Not necessarily, but throughout history, that's true. Throughout history, conquered people, you killed them, raped them, and sold them. I mean, that's just the reality. The Jews are under Roman rule. They've been under Roman rule for a long time, for example. That doesn't mean that they're all slaves. They have different legal rights, okay? Jews could be crucified, Romans could not, but that doesn't make them all slaves. But it could be that there's some of that they've captured people.
Why the British were slavery was illegal in England, and they even went so far as to close down slave markets where they found them, and yet we were sending ships to get them.
That's right. And why did slavery get illegal in England? One word, it's a name. Right. Don't know.
Why were they illegal?
Yeah, why was it illegal?
Wilberforce,
one word. One Christian. See, it's very hard to live above our culture. And people sit in judgment in our so-called cancel culture, and they look back at a statue of Robert E. Lee, and, oh, we got to tear that down. If you were in his culture, you would have likely have thought exactly the same. It's very rare and extraordinary for people to live above their culture. Christians should always live above our culture. And while Paul never denounces the slavery of Rome, Christians should have denounced the slavery that occurred in the United States. And in Britain, it ended much sooner because a Christian named Wilberforce was willing to put his neck on the line, and a bunch of people here who are Christians, who were Southern Baptists, sold out. That's a reality. You can go read the Southern Baptist Convention minutes from the early 1860s. They sold out. And it's to their great shame. Now, I'm not a cancel culture person. I'm into acknowledging mistakes so that we do better. But in our time, will we be a Wilberforce in different areas, right? So it's an interesting idea. Why did the slavery end sooner? Someone had to stand up. Paul never denounces the slavery, and there's a little book hiding in the New Testament called Philemon. Philemon is a book where Paul, who's in jail in Rome, has evangelized a runaway slave. What did Paul do? He sent him back to the slave owner, who is a Christian with a church in his house. Okay? So we just, and this gets us all confused when we read the word slave and we see, you know, maybe you read the book by Frederick Douglass or something, and you're seeing that kind of slavery. And all I'm saying is they're not the same thing. The Roman slavery had a lot of negatives, but, you know, some probably were conquered in some way, but a lot of these people signed up or they were born into it. But the interesting thing is you could buy your way out, which is what Paul's addressing when he says, if you can become free. Well, how would you become free? You're not talking about running away. You're talking about buying your way out. If you can purchase manumission. By the way, slaves own slaves. Some of the slaves in the big households did pretty well for themselves, and they had their own slaves. This wasn't an issue in that culture that bothered anybody. It's different. It's just hard for us to relate. Well, he says, if you can become free, if you can buy your way out, by all means, take the opportunity. So on the one hand, he's saying essentially, you know, be content to serve where you are. If you became a Christian as a slave, how would you serve where you are? You belong to a rich guy, he's got a big household, he's got a bunch of land. You'd evangelize right there. Who would you evangelize? You'd evangelize the guy that owns you. You'd evangelize the other slaves that work with you. See, you know, and so we think too often if we hear this idea of like calling, like, you know, you become a preacher because you were called to it. There's actually no verse in the whole New Testament that ever says that somebody was called to preach. Putting that aside, though, if we get down that thinking where some people are sort of called to do ministry and then there's the rest of us. I'm just, you know, an engineer, a physician, a real estate guy. God's called you to ministry and he's planted you where you're at.
Well,
and it's all different places. And
you refer to that as tent making. I mean, you got to have a way to make a living for yourself.
What you do.
Your Christian duty is number one. It's okay to pursue another.
But they're not separate. And that's what I'm getting at. See, they're not separate. Paul will say elsewhere, do everything as unto the Lord. Our vocation is the way in which God assigns us in a sphere of influence to be a Christian in that place. And for some people in the first century, that was as slaves. Okay? But like me, I'm not vocationally a pastor. Does that mean I don't have a ministry to do? No. And so you're a teacher, you're a landscaper, you're a photographer, you're wherever, you're retired, wherever God has you, but get to work.
The purpose of that is there's a lot of people that won't ever come to that church.
What?
There's a lot of people that won't ever come to that church.
That's right.
Well, how do you get to them? I mean, you talk to them where they're at.
That's right. A whole lot of people in our culture will not come to church. That meaning, they're not just going to show up. Now, that doesn't mean once they become a Christian, and I think at that point, they'll get it, they'll come, because this isn't man's idea. This is Jesus' project that we're a part of, being here today, First Baptist Church, Chapel Hill. But you're right. This whole idea has arisen in America the last several decades, that what I need to do to evangelize somebody is to get them up here to this church so the preacher can preach the gospel. That's the dumbest, dumb thing I've heard. The evangelism happens between Sundays. The primary goal of the pastor should be to teach you the Word of God, to equip you. There may be a place in that for the gospel message, or may not be.
I think you said but, this before, if you're a member of the body of Christ, you don't need evangelism. And you're going to the church, okay, you know, if you're a member of the church, you don't need evangelism.
Because you're already saved. What you need is the meat of the Word of God so you can grow. And it's good if someone gets evangelized at church. In the 1950s, if we had a Baptist church, there's a good chance you would have even some lost people come visit the church. It was still sort of cultural. We're at a time where lost people don't usually just come. If they come, someone brought them. They don't just show up. We had, when I was at Berean Baptist Church in Houston, we had visitors all the time, but very rarely were they people that were completely unchurched. Okay? Not saying they'd never come to church, but somebody has to go get them and bring them. Okay? And that's all I'm saying. So, your comment, I mean, that's wherever God has assigned you is your place to have a sphere of influence. Now build relationships with lost people. Earn the right to be heard. I promise you, God will open up opportunities. I've had tons of lost people ask me to give the gospel message. And they don't say it like that, but that's the question. Because if you build a relationship, you earn the right to be heard, they have questions. They have lots of questions. One of the questions I've gotten before, just again, it's like an entryway to the gospel, but you know, a family member died and they don't know if they can, Do they bury them or burn them up? That cremation question, I mean, it was a, well, let's talk about that. Because I want to talk about the resurrection. If he can resurrect the ones that died at sea and they're gone, there's not even ashes, he can resurrect the one that's in the urn on the mantle. So, but it opens up, and all of a sudden it opens up that opportunity. God will open those opportunities, but you have to be there, be willing. And Paul would say, I think here, if you're always sort of chasing the next opportunity, you're going to miss all the ones that were there where he put you.
Yeah.
Makes sense? Okay, so Paul says, you know, if you're a slave and you can get free, that's fine. What if you're already free? For he who is called by the Lord as a slave is the Lord's freedman. In other words, this whole slavery thing is a worldly construct anyway. That's why, you know, if you can buy your way out, that's fine. But you don't need it in order to be a good Christian, because you're already free in Christ. Then he goes on, likewise, he who is called as a free man, so a non-slave, you're already Christ's slave. That was the point earlier. Why? Because he bought you with a price. You were bought at a price. That word bought, remember, the market in Greek is called the agora. The verb here is agorazo. It's marketplace turned into a verb, because what you can buy there, in addition to chicken and fish and such things, is people. And he says you were bought at a price. And every Corinthian saw agorazo there, and they thought of that market in the middle of the city where people are for sale. And he says Jesus bought you out of that market of sin at a price. Do not become slaves of people. Be a slave of Christ. Brothers and sisters, each person is to remain with God in the situation in which he is called. So I hope that makes some sense. Now he's going to address unmarried people. There's some translation. Go ahead.
I think that today, you know, a lot of retired people feel they no longer have a function because they're not in some way, particularly in a specific way. And they look for new, and I've done this myself, I look for opportunities to do exactly what you're saying, to evangelize. And there are a few things old people say, well, why did God keep me here? And that's where what you're saying applies directly to that.
Yeah, that's right. And there's no retirement plan in the Bible. Realize that? I mean, he talks about, you know, laying up for the future, and you as a grandparent don't want the grandchildren to have to pay your bills. And he talks about that. But you know, I think there's been a weird sort of phenomenon, in part because of this movement toward trying to have the pastor do everything. The older generation in the church, and I mean the retirement folks, sometimes are unsure what to do. But the worst mistake would be to do nothing. And maybe there's been the church sometimes have not done good enough at pointing them to what they can and should do. But I will tell you, the little church I came from, and it about the size of this one, those deacons worked their butts off. And every one of them was closer to 80 than 70.
You get opportunities, and they are obvious.
They do, and you've got to take them.
You'll get opportunities, and it will be obvious.
And within what you're able to do, so at different stations in life, you can do more. And the reality is that, you know, physically, you may end up having limitations at some point, but you can do less. But what Paul would say to all of us, where you're at now, with what God's given you, with your restrictions and your limitations, and there may be a time when you have to give the keys up and can't drive, but you still have things you can do. And he would say, do them.
And I think this kind of enrichment contributes to that objective we should have.
Yeah.
You know, it allows you to refresh your thinking and take yourself and be directed to different interpretations of the scriptures that can help you in whatever mission you
have. Yeah, I agree. So he says now about virgins, and here's where there can be some translation issues. And all I can say, if you read several translations, you're going to see some differences in the rest of the book. But let's pass through this one fairly quickly. Try to wrap it up. Virgins? I think he means unmarried people. The assumption is, I mean, he uses this is verse 25. if you look up the word in a Greek dictionary, a lexicon, it will list a young, unmarried woman, presumably chaste, but then it'll also list as a definition just any young unmarried person. It can be a man. And so he says about the virgins, I have no command from the Lord, but I do give an opinion as the one who by the Lord's mercy is faithful. Because of the present distress, and that's that distress I mentioned earlier, I don't know what it is, but it is evident that it could be more difficult to be married sometimes in a time of distress than maybe if you were single. Whatever that distress, I think that it's good for a man to remain as he is, meaning single. Are you bound to a wife? Right? That's just a way, it's interesting how he says it. Never tell your wife you're bound to her. But he says it here. And in other words, are you married? Or at least, because it could be because of this context of a virgin, at least within a Jewish concept, if you were engaged, you're basically married already, even though you haven't consummated the marriage. Could be that. But he says if you're bound to a wife, don't seek to be released. Well, this is kind of like what he was saying earlier. If you're a slave, you don't need to seek to be free. If the opportunity comes up, that's okay, but you don't need to seek it. If you're free, you don't need to seek anything. You know, it's kind of the stay where you are. So the single guy, basically, stay single. He says, do not seek to be released. That could be in the context of an engagement where you wouldn't break off the engagement. It says if you're already engaged, you don't have to be unengaged. If you're already married, you don't have to get unmarried. But I think he has in mind more the engagement. Are you released from a wife? Now that would suggest either the breaking of an engagement or I think more probably here it's divorced. The word released is loosed. It's kind of a idiomatic. He says, are you loosed from a wife? Then I seek a wife. Okay. However, and this is the key part. And this is subject to more than one interpretation. If you do get married, who? The guy that was loose from his wife, i.e. presumably divorced, okay? If you do get married, you've not sinned. Now, he doesn't say that it wasn't a sin to get divorced if that's happened. That's a different issue. He's addressed that above. He basically said what God's ideal was. When you're married, you stay married until you're dead. But here he says if you're already loosed, he says, I think you shouldn't seek a wife. But if you get married, you do not sin. And the two ways to take that are either that it's a more broad statement that he is saying a divorced person can remarry, and that's the view I personally take, or he's talking perhaps more restrictedly of a guy who's been engaged and that's been broken off. I think that's less likely. That's more of a Jewish construct, and these are mostly non-Jewish people, but that's how I take that passage, that he's allowing for the remarriage. He's not saying that the getting the divorce is not a problem.
How can you have it both ways?
Well,
but
you already had it both ways, right? Because under the law, that Matthew 19 passage, remember that Moses had a certificate of divorce. So
that's the Old Testament.
That's right.
You said that applied to the New Testament.
That's right. But what I'm saying, you said, how can you have it both ways? And my point is, in the old and the new, in some sense, you had it both ways. That is, God never said go get a divorce. The question isn't whether you can get a divorce, because that's been narrowly limited. You shouldn't do it, okay? What's the problem? The country and this church and most churches are full of divorced people, okay? The question is, can they get remarried? That's a different issue. And I think he's saying yes. And I will tell you...
Well, it depends on what the divorce was over. No fault divorce law. Well, right. Typically that's not biblical. Biblical means that there's grounds for a divorce, which is adultery, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, see, that's what I've been trying to sort of argue, that the only passage that talks about this issue under the new covenant is this one. And I think under the old covenant, you could get a divorce and issue a certificate if you were Jewish. I think under the new covenant, the divorce is strictly disallowed. And I think there's virtually no exception, but I think that, the one he mentioned earlier, which is your spouse is not a Christian and they leave you. He says, let them leave. you're no longer bound to that marriage covenant, which by implication means you can now be remarried, but marry.
There are circumstances where a divorce.
Right, but see, that one didn't involve adultery at all.
I said there are places in Scripture where it tells you when you can be divorced.
The places in this passage only.
Yeah.
So I'm making a stronger statement, and I'm not saying that I'm not right about everything. People disagree. In this passage, all he says is, if you've been loose from a wife, you ought to stay single. That's his general mantra through the whole chapter. Stay where you're at. But if you do remarry, you've not sinned. That's what he says. He doesn't say if you remarry after divorcing a wife that committed adultery. He doesn't say remarry after you're out of a marriage because of she died. It just, that's all he says. If you remarry, that's okay. My take on that verse is he's not condoning the divorce for whatever reason, even a bad one, okay? Even because there was an affair, whatever it was. I think he allows the remarriage. There are those who would say it's a very narrow circumstance where essentially you've broken off an engagement. I just don't think that might make some sense to a Jewish audience. I don't think it would make sense to the Corinthians. I think when he says, if you're loose from a wife, should you get married? No, stay single, present distress. But if you get married, go ahead, that's fine. Why would you do that?
He actually says
that
Scripture don't get married at all.
But he's saying marriage is a physical thing, and that is that you have to go before a certified official and go through the procedure of hereby being married.
Never talks about the ceremony.
Okay.
Never talks about the ceremony itself.
So when they say marriage, they mean...
Married. You could go to the JP, you can go in front of a preacher. I've done a couple of weddings. Okay. But, that part I don't think's there. Well, let's press on. That's my view. My view is, and again, you have to deal with this in some way. I will tell you, I know of a lot of churches. In fact, I was at a large church in Houston. I can remember that this just popped back in my head, but there was a young man who now pastors a big church. Very young guy at that time, but anyway, he would not counsel or have anything to do with any remarried church members. He would not provide any counseling because he took the view that they were in their new marriage, even with kids and all that, they were living in adultery, which raises an interesting question. If you think the remarriage is adulterous, shouldn't you be commanding them to get divorced? If Paul forbid you getting remarried, wouldn't he have somewhere in here where he'd say, you better divorce her, divorce him? Right? It's not there. Instead, you have this verse, if you're loose from him, you don't have to marry, but you can. If you do, you haven't sinned. So I'm just saying, this is a real practical issue, especially, it was easy a couple hundred years ago when there were no divorces in this country. But since, there were divorces in the early part of the century, but since the 1940s, you've got to deal with it. And dealing with it and deciding that you're not going to minister to people who are remarried is probably not the best way. But you have to come to your conviction. So, continuing on then, he says, however, if you get married, you've not sinned. And if a virgin marries, you see how he's dealing with a different group of people? You've been loose from a wife, you get remarried, it's not sinned. If a virgin marries, now is he talking about just a young lady? He'll make it pretty clear. She has not sinned. Okay? So he's got someone who's loose from a wife. You can go marry. That's a man. He's got someone who's never been married. You can marry. If you marry, it's not a sin.
I think that was a sin.
But that's that celibacy thing again. If you lived in a culture where worship was going to the temple prostitute, you might think having sex was a sin. But such people will have trouble in this life. The thing husbands might think but never say publicly. Such people will have trouble in this life, right? Marriage can bring its own troubles because people have struggles because no one's as perfect as we are. They don't realize what a good catch they have, and so they make demands of us, right? We have friction. And in addition to that, if you were facing persecution, that is harder if you have a wife to protect, children to protect. So he's just saying, I'm trying to spare you. I'm trying to spare you some pain that will come through this, but you can do it. This is what I mean, brothers and sisters. The time is short. Time is limited. I think he means before the Lord's return. Paul always expected that to happen tomorrow. So from now on, those who have wives should be as though they had none. That is, just don't get so caught up in the purely earthly matters, even your marriage, as good as that is, and it deserves attention, it deserves time, but it's not your whole life. Your job isn't your whole life. Your cars aren't your whole life. Time's limited. Those who weep as though they did not weep, those who rejoice as though they did not rejoice, these are earthly things that can sort of consume us. Those who buy as though they didn't own anything, and those who use the world as though they did not make full use of it, for this world in its current form is passing away. And when the world passes away, so will marriage, by the way. And a lot of those things that can be so consuming, and they're not bad things, it's just that they can take us away from devotion to God, I think is Paul's concern. I want you to be, he says in verse 32, without concerns. The unmarried man is concerned about the things of the Lord. Why? Because he doesn't have a wife and honey-do list and all these things. And it's very challenging. It is time-intensive to build healthy relationships. And with your spouse, that's going to be the most time-intensive one. And you should. And he's just recognizing the obvious. If you were single and you were so guided to do ministry, it will be easier. You're going to focus on the things of the Lord, how you may please the Lord, but the married man's concerned about the things of the world, how he may please his wife, and his interests are divided. The unmarried woman or virgin is concerned about, why would he list both? The unmarried woman could be a widow, right? The unmarried woman or virgin is concerned about the things of the Lord so that she may be holy in body and spirit, but the married woman is concerned about the things of the world, how may she may please her husband. You can understand why in history from a passage like this you would have people become nuns, right? I mean, or even start saying, well, maybe the priest should never be married. I think that's a mistake because Paul never commands it, but you can see where they're coming from. Like, they're not totally unhinged from the scripture. If being single would help you minister better, then why not be single, right? So he says that. I'm saying this in verse 35 for your own benefit, not to put a restraint on you, but to promote what's proper so you may be devoted to the Lord without distraction. And now these last couple paragraphs, we'll just read through this quickly, but I think this is pretty set now. If any man is acting improperly toward the virgin he is engaged to. Now, some other translations will say if a father is acting improperly toward his daughter. This is that part where I was saying the translations vary wildly. Frankly, you can defend both positions. There's some textual issues I don't want to get into, but it's interesting that he never refers to a father here. That word doesn't appear. It's inferred because there is a verb used in here for giving someone in marriage, which would suggest a father giving a daughter away in marriage. I think you can make sense of both. This modern translation takes the more, as most modern translations do, takes it as a person who's engaged, maybe, who's thinking about backing away from that. The King James takes the father-daughter view, and I put that out there because it will give you a little different instruction. If a man thinks he's acting improperly toward the virgin he's engaged to, improperly how? By not getting married. I mean, she waits around long enough, she's gonna essentially have the window of time for marrying a young man, pass her by, or maybe the window for having children. If she's getting beyond the usual age for marriage and he feels he should marry, he can do what he wants. He says, if you want to marry the girl you're engaged to, get married. He's not sinning. They can get married. But he who stands firm in his heart, a guy who just feels, you know what, I don't want to get married, who's under no compulsion but has control over his own will, he's decided in his heart to keep her as his fiancée, you'll do well, he says. Now, you can put the same thing in the context of the father who might be concerned that his daughter, you know, should I give her in marriage? Should I forbid her to be married? Because, you know, you have a culture where a lot of marriages might have been arranged. He says, so then he who marries his fiancée does well, and he does not marry will do better. Back to his thing about singleness. Final thing, a wife is bound as long as her husband's living. Now, this part's the non-controversial part. If the old man kicks the bucket, she can remarry. If her husband dies, she's free to be married to anyone she wants. Only, okay, that last phrase, only in the Lord. Who would that be? A Christian. That's the one place where Paul's very strong, and he'll say later to not be unequally, I think it's later, but he'll say no, don't be unequally yoked. This has been largely abandoned by our culture. I mean, just Christian people marry non-Christians all the time, and I shared a little about this last time. It works out badly. It usually works good until children come along, then it works out badly. In a lot of ways. I've known lots of people who come to church by themselves because their spouse is not a Christian, and it pains them. And then I've known others who, when the children come along, the spouse says, you cannot take them to church, or even says, they're going to the mosque with me. And I mean, it's an issue, and it gets avoided very easily. Marry a Christian. Now, I would add one other thing. Do you think all Christians are equally yoked?
No.
Mm-mm. What if, and this happens a lot, what if a young lady who's very serious about the Lord, I mean, she's in her Bible, she's volunteering at a food pantry, I mean, she's really serious about serving. Church is important to her. She meets a young man, and he's dazzling and tall and has a cool car, and he says he's a Christian, he got saved in summer camp. Does that mean necessarily they're equally yoked? What if he's not really a serious Christian? He's more a sideline guy. I mean, he goes on Mother's Day, make sure God's still there. How will that work? Do you think some Christian guys would have enough sense to, if they're looking for a wife, to come to church to find one? And then get married and then not come to church anymore? I've watched it happen over and over. Yeah. No, it's really all I'm throwing out when we talk about marrying a Christian, you're not equally yoked if you have completely different backgrounds. So I'm not per se saying Baptist should marry a Baptist. What I'm telling you is you could have a Baptist marry a Roman Catholic, and they could both be very serious about their faith, and they're so sort of at odds, you end up having this friction about what to do. And I've witnessed that, and people get divorced because they're Christians. And I've had others where, and it's usually the woman who's very serious about the things of God, and she marries a guy who claims to be a Christian, and I'm not doubting that, but he is not serious about church. And until the moment they walk down the aisle, he's at church every Sunday. I've had them in my classes teaching married couples, and I could see it coming. I knew it was going to be, I can't open my mouth, but I'm a pretty good judge of that usually. I'm like, the day they walk down the aisle, he ain't going to be here again, and he never is. Think they were equally yoked? I'm just telling you, so we need to be careful in how we think about this. It's not just go marry a Christian. A wife ought to marry a husband who can be a leader in her home. So anyway, that's what he says, only in the Lord. But she's happier if she remains as she is, that is single in my opinion. And I think that I also have the Spirit of God when he's sharing these words. So we'll leave it there. That's a long chapter, but I wanted to get through it. I mean, it's a lot, but just have this in mind. The primary passage you need to go to determine what you believe about marriage and divorce and remarriage and all that is here. There are the other three passages I mentioned. We need to understand them. There's room for debate on this. But if you're going to find the answer, it's here. Well.